Let's dive in here. We are in 1 Samuel chapter 24. As I said this morning, we'll be talking about unrequited mercy. Many stories in the world that are built upon unrequited love. In fact, Anne of Green Gables is one of them for a little while. Oh, what is his name? I forget. Huh? Gilbert. That's right. Gilbert. Just loves Anne, but she can't settle down with a guy for some reason. And she's too spunky, too spirited, and so she tells him no, and you guys have seen it. You know the story. Unrequited love, and it can be heartbreaking. Well, David has already had quite a bit of unrequited mercy to Saul. He spent years of his early life in his late teens and early 20s ministering to Saul with his harp, or as we looked at back then, it's a little more like a guitar than it is what you think of as a harp with a little gold thing and the curlicue and looked a lot more like a guitar that he learned to play while watching his father's sheep. And he played for Saul, and that helped Saul in his moments of extreme discouragement when a harmful spirit from the Lord was upon Saul. David fought for Saul, killed Goliath by himself, instituted a great victory in Israel that day against the Philistines, and then spent the next few years of his life fighting the Philistines and strengthening Saul's kingdom. And how does Saul respond to all that? With suspicion, with paranoia, with attempts on David's life, and finally chasing David out of his home, away from his wife, and making David have to flee into the wilderness. We're going to take a look at our map here for just a second to get an idea of where we are, because when we last left David in the end of chapter 23, he was in... it didn't switch. Hold on a second. Let's duplicate this screen. He was in the region of Hebron and Ziph and Maon. Now you can see it, right? Okay. He had fled from Jerusalem, or not Jerusalem, sorry. He had fled from Gibeah of Benjamin up here north of Jerusalem. He went to Nob, where he consulted with Ahimelech the priest, and then he fled over to Gath, where he tried to get into the service of the king of Gath. Well, he was recognized there and nearly killed, and he escaped with his life, wrote a psalm about it, came back and dwelt here around Adullam in the caves of the wilderness here. When he heard about a Philistine attack upon the city of Keilah, he decided to intervene, him and his 400 men. They went down, routed the Philistines, and then dwelt in Keilah for a little while, until Saul heard that he was dwelling at Keilah. Saul amassed the army of Israel and was coming down to surround Keilah. David inquired of the Lord whether or not the inhabitants of that city would deliver him into Saul's hand, and the answer from God was, yes, they will. So David fled from Keilah. You see him fleeing from one place to the next, trying to stay one step ahead of Saul. He fled from Keilah and came down here to the region of Ziph, and just a little bit south of there in Maon. Around this area, we saw that there was a forest. In verse 16 of chapter 23, he was in. So, and Saul's son rose and went to David at Horesh, which means a forest or a thicket, that word Horesh. And it says that it's south of Ziph. And so somewhere right around in here, there used to be a forest, and that's where David had his hiding place. Saul heard that David was there because the people from the town and from the area went to Saul and told Saul, David's hiding here. Come get him. We'll help you. So once again, David's being rejected by the people of Israel, and he's having them help Saul against him. So he fled that area, and what happened there? I made a swipe, and now we're not where we're supposed to be. He fled from that area and went a little bit farther south to the regions of Maon. Saul came down to try to capture him. That's where we read that wonderful account of David escaping, as they say, by the skin of his teeth. As he's circling around one side of the mountain, and Saul is circling around the other, but Saul's closing in on him. And the only thing that saved David that day was that a messenger arrived and told Saul, the Philistines are attacking, you've got to come help us. We get no details about where the Philistines are attacking or who they're attacking. Just what's important to the story here, sorry, the narrative, right, Dan? Yeah, we got that this morning. What's important to the narrative that God was rescuing David by means of this type of intervention. The Philistines came to attack Israel. Saul, as the king, is bound to go and deliver his people, so he has to leave off the chase of David in order to go and rescue his people from the Philistines. And that gave David a chance to escape around the mountain. And it says in the last part of chapter 23, David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. En-Gedi is this region right over here on the western side of the Dead Sea. Okay. I don't know if you can see on here how this is a much lighter area. It's because on this map, this is a topographical map, and it's trying to give you a 3D image, which doesn't come across real well on our projector. But you start off on the coastlands over here of the Mediterranean Sea, where the Philistines live, okay? Over here at Ashkelon, Gaza, Ashdod, Gath, Ekron. This is all very, very flat, plain land. Very good farmland, and you can kind of see on the picture here that it's all divvied up into fields. It's because it's very, very fertile ground. And so the Philistines possess all this territory. Then as you get over here a little further to the east, you get into the foothills and the mountainous regions of Judea. Where you hit this broad white stripe is the peak of the mountains right here. It runs from about Jerusalem, south through Bethlehem to Hebron, down through Ziph and Moan. And when you get south of here, you get into the wilderness regions, which is just desolate, desolate place. Not too many people living down in there. I don't think there were that many people living there during David's time. There's certainly not very many people wandering down there now, except for some of the nomadic people. But it's a desolate place. But this mountain range peaks right around here, and you can't quite see this on the screen up there, but these peaks top off at somewhere around 3,000, some of them 3,500 feet above sea level. So these are right in the range of the size of the Appalachian Mountains. Anybody ever driven through the Appalachians? Isn't that beautiful? I love the Appalachian Mountain Range. Now, I've only ever been close enough to see the Rocky Mountains there at, not Denver, what's that? It wasn't Denver, though. Colorado Springs, that's right. And so we've stayed in Colorado Springs, and I got to look up at Pikes Peak and say, boy, I'd really like to go up there. And then the next day we were going to go up, and it snowed. It just opened up, and all the roads closed down, and we had to go home. So, didn't get to see it. But the Appalachians, beautiful, beautiful mountains. And though they are not as steep and tall as the Rocky Mountains, they are difficult to traverse if you don't have roads. Because some of the valleys are very, very deep. The mountainsides are fairly steep. And that's somewhat what this region here looks like. So you've got mountains here about 3,200 feet above sea level. And then you start the descent down to the Dead Sea Valley. The Dead Sea sits 1,300 feet below sea level. Okay, so when you're down at the Dead Sea, you're actually in a gigantic pit in the earth, and it's hot. The day I was there, it was 125 degrees. So you're just standing out there in the sunshine, and I mean, you're just dumping buckets of sweat, but the drops don't even hit the ground because they evaporate and go up in a little steam. So the Dead Sea is way, way, way below sea level. It is the lowest place on the earth that's not submerged by ocean. The Dead Sea is fed by one source, and that is the Jordan River up here at its northern end. And it has no outlets. It does get some of these wadis when it rains. They channel water into it. But the only constant source is the Jordan River up here to the north. And so the Jordan River keeps pulling salts and minerals from its sources up near Galilee and the mountains to the north of Israel, brings them all down to the Dead Sea and drops them, and there's nowhere for that water to go because you can't flow any lower than the lowest point on earth, right? Water doesn't go uphill. That's what makes shingling our roofs possible. And so you're down at this lowest point on earth, and that is why the Dead Sea is the Dead Sea, because all these salts and minerals are being dumped into it. The sun heats it, evaporates the water, leaves the salts in the water, and so the Dead Sea is 3.5 times saltier than the ocean. Nothing lives in it. It is truly a dead body of water because nothing can grow there. Although it is a great place for us to harvest salts and minerals of all sorts, including gold and silver and even some of the rare earth elements that we need are in that salt. Anyhow, David has gone and he has hidden himself in these mountainous regions. En-Gedi, though it's pinpointed right here on the shores of the Dead Sea, really encapsulates an area all around here. It's very, very mountainous, and it changes from the sort of rolling hills up here around Hebron and Ziph to very steep, craggy hills with lots of ravines and things. And I took some pictures for you, so we're going to go back to this edition, and hopefully you will see these pictures, because I know everybody likes to see slideshows of someone else's vacation, right? Let's see. Nope, that's not going to bring it up, huh? So let me try here again. I had the opportunity some years back when I was in college to go to the Holy Land a couple of times. And the first time I was there, I took about 35 rolls of 35 millimeter film of pictures. Second time, I took about 40 rolls of film and I filled them all up. And if anybody wants, I don't know why anybody would, but if you want, you can ask, and I'll bring you my book full of pictures, and you can flip through it. It's all labeled with things, so you know where it is, but I know how that is, okay? I won't bore you with any more details about that. This picture here is a picture of En-Gedi. You're looking out over the southern hills of Judea, and you can see that today nothing grows there except that little patch of green that's right down there in the middle of the picture. See if I can get my highlighter on. Okay. Is that showing up? Yeah. So right there you've got a little bit of green because there's a waterfall there. And so all the water draining off these hills comes down, pours down here, and so you get some plants growing there. We've talked before about the change in topography and climate over there in Israel since the 3,000 years ago when David was living. And probably there was a lot more vegetation there then than there is now. But this gives you an idea of the terrain and how steep or not steep it is. But you can see there's a ravine running right through here, and the clefts of it are extremely steep. And so it's a treacherous place to try to travel in. So if you don't have a way across that ravine is a pretty big barrier to your movement. You either have to follow it all the way up to its top end where it shallows out enough that you can cross it, or you have to go all the way down to the Dead Sea and go around it. Or you have to venture down the steep sides, which you might try. But that's a picture looking from En-Gedi out over the hills of Judah. This next one is just looking at some of the mountains that are here in En-Gedi, and you can see they're steep, they're tall. Again, you're going from 1,300 feet below sea level, 1 mile from the Dead Sea, the altitude is up to about 700 feet above sea level. So you, in 1 mile, you've gained 2,000 feet of altitude. 2 miles away from the Dead Sea, you're up another 400 or 500 feet. 3 miles from the Dead Sea, you're up to about the 3,000s. And so you have in a very short distance of time these hills just getting bigger and bigger as you travel away from the Dead Sea. And they come down and they have a very steep drop that goes down to the shoreline of the Dead Sea. Today, little tidbit for you trivia buffs, today there is no water flowing into the Dead Sea. Israel has channeled all the water of the Jordan River off to irrigation. And so there is no more water flowing into the Dead Sea except when it rains, so the Dead Sea is going down. And so it's shrinking, and that's leaving more and more exposed land along the base of it, but it's extremely fertile farmland where all those salts are. They grow figs and things that need high mineral content and salt grow very, very well down there. But you can see you're standing down here sort of on the shore of the Dead Sea and you're looking up at these mountains. So the initial climb up into the mountains of En-Gedi are very, very steep cliffs. And all through there you can see those caves. You can see these little dark spots. These are caves. There's these rocky outcrops where the Dead Sea used to be at that level. And the sides of the mountains are very sheer. So it's a tough place to traverse in, but it also makes it a great place to hide. because it's difficult for an army or a large group of people to move around there. So that's looking from the Dead Sea up. Right here is an example of one of the caves that exists in Gedi. As you get down to the bottom of those ravines, there's a little bit more water and more things are growing down there because of the water. And so when you get all the way down to the bottom here, you have this waterfall coming down, and it has carved a very large cave at the back of this ravine, and that's this dark spot right here. All this green is vegetation and things growing, and so this is where the animals are going to mostly congregate. But En Gedi is full of caves of this size. One person who went over to study the topography in relation to the biblical accounts said he found a cave that could easily house 30,000 people. That's a big cave. So it has one main cave, and it has many, many side caves branching off in different directions. And how the water carved these things would be a really interesting study for Answers in Genesis to get into, but as far as I know, they haven't studied that particular region yet. But this is the kind of cave that we're talking about when we get to this account of David. Last picture here again, looking up at a hill so you can see the steep cliffs and just the rockiness of the area. So that's really what we're looking at here as David is hiding from Saul. So chapter 24, verse 1, when Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En Gedi." This is following right on the heels of David's narrow escape. Saul went off, he fought the Philistines, he's finished that fight, and he heard that David has left Maon and has now traveled over to the Dead Sea. Flip that for you guys. Traveled over to the Dead Sea and is in the regions of En Gedi and these steep cliffs and that rocky area. Verse 2, then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel. Probably he took these 3,000 out of the army that he would have had to gather together to fight the Philistines. So he gathers the best of them and says, "All right, you're going on extended duty. You're coming with me for a little tromps through the wilderness. We're going to go find David." 3,000 men. How many men does David have? He's got about 600 men, so sounds like a fair fight, right? Okay, well, probably is when you add David and all the mighty men that are with him. I don't think I'd want to face those guys with 30,000 men. It would have been a tough fight. So Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the Wild Goats Rocks. Probably that's not a proper name. My ESV translation has that capitalized like it's a proper name. But the thing is that all over in Gedi, there are little goats that run around, wild mountain goats. And there's little deer. You've heard the song. We have it as a chorus today, and it's taken from one of the Psalms. As the hart pants for the water, or as the deer pants for the water, so my soul pants after thee, O God. This is these little deer and these little goats that run around in Gedi. They're not very big. They're about the size of Pete, and they can spring around on those rocky mountain crags without losing their footing. And you can see from the pictures why they're panting for the water, because there's not much of it there in Gedi. So they would go down into those valleys. That's where they would eat. They would get the water, and then they would go climbing and frolicking all over the mountains to their little heart's content. So he's in the Wild Goats Rocks, just meaning this very rough portion of En Gedi. It's not the place where people are wandering for leisurely strolls, and Eldon probably would not want to try to ride his bike there. It would be a very difficult ride for him. And he came to the sheepfolds, by the way, where there was a cave. This is, again, not hard for us to imagine. We saw the cave in the one picture, and there are many such caves scattered all throughout En Gedi. And so the shepherds would use them to house their sheep in the heat of the day. You can understand when it's getting 120, 130 degrees outside that you want a cool place to go to get out of the sun. How many of you love your air conditioning in those hot August days? Yep, I'm all for it. So we go inside to hide ourselves from the hot sun, and so did the sheep. And so they would all gather in these caves to get out of the hot sun and to cool off until the afternoon came and a little bit cooler weather. And so Saul finds one of these caves where the sheep are wont to hide, and the Bedouin, the that inhabit that place. They would take their sheep in there. It says, he came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went into... Now, King James people, so who's got a KJV? Gary, you've got one, right? What's that read there? This is verse 3. Saul went in. End of the verse there. Okay, Saul went in to cover his feet. Now, without being too crass, this is a Hebrew expression meaning to go to the bathroom. Okay, my ESV says Saul went in to relieve himself. And the issue is that it says cover his feet because he would have to go in and drop his robes to be able to go to the bathroom and relieve himself with a bowel movement. So obviously he doesn't want to do this out in front of all of his men, so he goes into this cave for a little bit of privacy. Unbeknownst to him, who is inhabiting his bathroom? Abby?
David.
Sometimes in our house, with lots of little hands around, it's hard to get a few moments where they're not knocking on doors and wanting something. So you have to go into the bathroom, and then all of a sudden it's, Mom, Dad, I need this, I need this. And she said, just give me a few minutes, right? Okay, well, Saul goes in, he wants a few moments of privacy, and little does he know there's 600 men standing around the sides of the cave watching what happens. Because Saul has no idea that David is right there. Because if you'll notice the phrase that's used here, he came to the sheepfolds by the way. Saul is still heading towards a destination. He's going to go down to the Dead Sea probably and search for David there at the part of En-Gedi that's right by the Dead Sea, but he doesn't realize David's in this cave. What a coincidence. Out of all the thousands of caves in En-Gedi, Saul picks the one that David and his men are hiding in. And I can imagine them as they see Saul's army coming from the distance, and they give the alarm, everybody hide, get in the cave. So they go back in the cave, they put out their campfires, they gather up all their stuff, and they run back into the side caverns of this cave. And they're listening as Saul's army gets closer and closer, and they're probably holding their breath saying, please pass by, please pass by. David, I'm certain, is praying heavily. God, spare me. Deliver me from my enemy here. Don't let him find us in this cave. And then, I know I'm extrapolating and I'm imagining a little bit here, so we'll just understand we're doing that. But imagine what David's thinking when Saul walks into the very cave that David's hiding in. I played a game of hide-and-seek one time with a youth group, and this is obviously nowhere near the same because my life was in no danger. But we played it completely in the dark, no lights on anywhere in the building. We even shut off the exit lights, just don't tell the fire marshal. Okay. And so I was in the kitchen, and I was standing on the counter, right in the middle of the counter, just standing there. And I hear one of the people come in the room, and they're talking, and they're patting all over the counter. And they go all the way around this island that I'm standing on, patting the counter, and never once touched my foot. And they went in, they searched the kitchen, they walked out, and never found me. So, again, my life's not in danger, so that really has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about here. David, his life is in danger. Saul finds him in this cave, it's all over, because probably there's not too much of another way out. And Saul's got 3,000 men at the entrance of the cave. And Saul says to his men, hang on, I got to go in here for a few minutes. So he goes in, starts to do what he needs to do. David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave, and the men of David said to him, they see an opportunity here. Because not only is Saul in the cave, he's probably by himself. Being the king of Israel, you don't want to be seen in such a demeaning position. So he's probably by himself. Secondly, given their clothing and the way they had to do this, if all his robes are around his feet, how mobile is he going to be? Not very. Saul's rather helpless at this point. He's very, very defenseless, and because he doesn't even know his enemy is in the cave, so David's men got an idea. Here is the day of which the Lord spoke to you. Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. Sounds good, right? Saul's right here. David, this is the day. This is it. Take care of him right now. You'll never know what hit him, and all this hiding will be over. We can go home. You'll be the king. Isn't this what God promised you? God said you're going to be the king someday. This is your chance. Take it. And all his men are pressing him to take this opportunity and kill Saul where he sits. There's only one trouble. When did God ever say to David, I'm going to deliver Saul into your hand? As far as we know, never. Did God promise David you're going to be the king of Israel? Yes, he did. Does that mean that Saul has to somehow be taken out of the way? Yes, it does. Whether Saul would resign or whether Saul would be killed, one way or the other, Saul has to be taken out of the equation for David to become king. But never did God tell David, I want you to kill Saul. But here are his men looking at this and saying, well, you know, God told you you're going to be king. Right there's the guy standing in your way. Take care of it. This will be easy. We'll help you. It's 400-1. And once all those men outside realize that Saul's dead, you know they're going to scatter. They'll rally around. You come on, David. Take this opportunity. And David rose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, I'll pull this one over and over in my mind, and I try to imagine how in the world Saul didn't hear this or notice it somehow, but despite my best imaginings, I can't come up with it, but guess what? Who cares if I can imagine it or not? Does that make it not true? Not at all. Somehow, David sneaks up beside Saul and cuts a portion of his robe off. This would have been the outer robe that Saul wore. Probably when he was getting ready to do his business, he cast that off to the side so that it wouldn't get dirty. And it's over there out of the way, which would be one of the reasons David could get at it without being noticed. So he stealthily crawls up there, cuts a corner of it off, and takes it back to his men in the back of the cave. But afterwards, there's a problem. David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now we've got to take notice here of a major contrast between these two men in this cave. Here's Saul, who when he was commanded to utterly destroy the Amalekites, didn't do so and made all sorts of excuses about why he didn't, and never admitted that what he had done was wrong. Here's a man who, when David fled from him, ordered the complete destruction of an entire city of God's priests. Here's a man that's been chasing David all over the countryside when David has offered nothing but help to Saul. That's Saul. And on the other hand, we have David, who when given a command regarding his king, because God commanded in the Old Testament how you were supposed to honor the king, how you were supposed to treat the king. And David is so stricken even by this simple act of dishonoring the king's clothing by cutting a portion off of it, that his conscience strikes him. And he realizes this is not how the king should be treated. This is God's anointed man. Even if he is disobeyed, he's still God's anointed man. It's not my place to undo him. How often we feel like we have to step in and do something. You say, well, I know God wants this to happen, and I know God wants this to happen. I got to make it happen, so I got to get in there and try and force it. David says, no, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done this. Even this simple act of cutting his robe was an act of dishonor to God's anointed. His heart struck him. Have you had that feeling? You do something, and immediately that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach, I know I've done wrong. Okay? Here's where David's at, and the contrast is between these two guys, one who is so hardened to God and God's commands that he'll make any excuse he can think of to excuse why he didn't obey, and on the other hand, we have David, who with a simple act that nobody would probably think anything about, he says, no, that was wrong. He's so sensitive to God's moving in his life. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. There's his whole reasoning. God anointed Saul. So who has the right to take Saul out of the way? Only God. And did God ever give David a command to do it? No. So David's reasoning is so simple, I don't have the authority to kill him. There's going to come a day when David, as the king of Israel, has the authority to take life in God's name for just reasons. He recognizes it's not today, and it's not him. God anointed that man So it's God's responsibility to take care of him the way that God sees fit. And that's his whole reasoning. Simple. Does it create some problems for his men? Do you think they resisted this a little bit? You know, I can imagine them doing so. We're not told that they do, but I can imagine them saying, what are you talking about? He's right there. Of course, they'd have to be whispering in the back of the caves, right? He's right there. Just go get him. David says, no. You know how often we convolute things and make it difficult with our own reasoning? God's answers are always simple. They're not easy, but they're simple. I mean, how much logic does it take to get to David's position here? Not a whole lot. It's pretty easy. Point number one, God anointed Saul. Point number two, God didn't tell me to put out my hand against him. That's it. David's reasoning is so simple there. I'm just going to do what God told me to do. And if that means I have to run and flee in the wilderness for a little bit longer, then I will do that. Because that's what God told me to do. We so often, though, we want to make our lives a little bit more comfortable, so we're willing to try and finagle things and make excuses and say, well, God wants me to be happy. And God wants you to obey him. You'll never find greater happiness than being completely contented in doing what God told you to do, no matter what all the other circumstances around it are. So, David refuses to put out his hand to strike Saul. The only thing he does, cut off that robe, and even that is too much for David. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. This has to be a strong-willed guy. 600 men want you to do something, and you stand up and say no, and they all listen to you. And they all say, okay, we not really don't like it much, but okay, that's where it's at. So David leads his men. He's already learning to lead them like a king. Saul rose up. He finished his business. He left the cave and went on his way. So he's out, tells the men, okay, I'm done. Let's get moving. We're going to head down to En-Gedi. We're going to find David. Verse 8, afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave. Watch where you step. And called after Saul. Sorry, that's a little, yeah. You might say I wasn't going to be crass about it. He called after Saul. So David comes walking out of the cave. Saul is apparently a little bit of a distance away because he doesn't see David here, and he hears him, though. My lord, the king! You notice the respect that David is throwing out here? He's still calling Saul my lord. He's still walking in submission to him. He said, my lord, the king, gets his attention. When Saul looked behind him, what's David do? He bows with his face to the earth and paid homage. Wow! This guy's been chasing you all over your country, making you hide in caves and then making you sleep in the dirt and chasing you out of city after city after city, took away your wife, and you're still going to bow before him? It's not very American of him, is it? We value our independence. No way. No, don't you take my guns away from me. But you know what? Here's David, and he's so content to be right where God put him. He's so content to do exactly what God told him to do. He bows before Saul, pays homage to him, shows Saul, I'm not a threat to you. I'm still submitting to you. Verse 9, and David said to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks your harm? So he's challenging Saul with listening to the people that are saying David's trying to oust you as the king. David has never once tried to oust Saul as the king. So David's challenging Saul, why are you listening to the people? Verse 10, behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. Now, at this point, Saul's probably saying, because you just came out of the cave I was just in. You were in there, but now it gets even better because David's going to hold up some evidence. See, my father, did you love that term? Not just as a term of respect to a leader, but this is literally David's father. David married his daughter. See, my father, I lost it. See the corner of your robe in my hand? And David's holding up this piece of the robe, and at this point, Saul is desperately picking up his robe, looking for where it was cut off from. And behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you, and may the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall never be against you. David is stating in no uncertain terms, Saul, you have no reason to be pursuing me. I'm no threat to you. I will never lift up my hand against you to harm you. And I can prove it because I just had an opportunity to do it and didn't. And in fact, I even had to restrain my men who wanted to lift up their hands against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes wickedness. What he's saying here is, if I'm wicked, I would have done a wicked thing. If I'm truly a treasonous, wicked person, you'd be dead. And we wouldn't be having this conversation. But you're standing here talking to me. That proves I'm not wicked. I haven't done anything wrong. But my hand shall not be against you. And notice what he's going to do here in verses 14 and 15. He's defending himself throughout this whole little speech that he's giving. First by saying that he hasn't done anything wrong. First by saying that he didn't take an opportunity to kill Saul. Therefore, Saul has no reason to fear him. And secondly, by justifying himself and saying, I haven't done anything wrong. You have no right to be hunting me. Verse 14, the third thing he's going to bring up. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you chasing? Just think about this, Saul. Who in the world are you chasing? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog. You have to chase a dead dog? Is a dead dog going to hurt your chickens? Probably not. After a flea. How much effort do you put into finding one flea? Well, maybe a dozen fleas you find on your dog, you're going to put them in the bathtub. But this is a little flea. Okay, they're small, they're nothing. May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it, and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. So David is clearly putting his deliverance in God's hands, not in his own. And he just displayed that by refusing to reach out his hand and attack Saul. And he tells Saul, God's going to take care of this. You're going wrong, you shouldn't be chasing me. God's going to take care of this, and I'm going to let him do it. Who would you rather deal with, David or God? If you're Saul. Oh boy, I don't know, I think I'd almost... If I have to be disciplined by someone, God's merciful, so he might ease up on me a little bit, but nobody can discipline you like the Lord can. As soon as David had finished speaking, here's the effect that this is going to have on Saul. As soon as he had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, is this your voice, my son, David? So apparently he's far enough away from him that he doesn't see very well, but he could hear who it is. And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Finally, something's breaking through that hardness that Saul's got on his heart. He said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. He recognizes what David has just done. And the weight of that is on him at the moment. Now, we have seen from Saul some tendencies, though. He's back, he's forth, he's up, he's down. Saul is an extremely unstable guy. So the fact that he is turning away from his desire to kill David now doesn't yet give us a whole lot of hope for what he's going to do in the future. You have declared this day how you have dealt well with me and that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. And everybody just saw it. All 3,000 of those men standing there know that I should be dead right now. But I'm not. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? What's the answer you're expecting from that question? Not a chance. You don't let your enemy get away because then he'll probably attack you again some other day. But Saul says, you're normally speaking, you kill your enemy. But David, you had an opportunity like that today and you didn't take it. So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. Saul's fully acknowledging, finally, for about the first time in his life, he's fully acknowledging what's going on here. He's acknowledging his wrong. He's acknowledging David's righteousness. He's going to take that even a little bit farther in verse 20. And now, behold, I know you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Do you realize this is the first time that Saul has ever admitted this? This is the first time Saul has ever even hinted at coming to grips with the fact that he's been rejected and David's been anointed. I know you're going to be king. Kingdom of Israel will be established in your hand. Verse 21 is something that Saul would like to see from David. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house. This is a legitimate desire. As we've talked about before, when kingdoms were transferred from one dynasty to the next, very often the previous dynasty didn't survive. And nobody that could even claim the throne, down to distant relatives, survived the transition. Because the new dynasty wanted to make sure there were no rebel claims to the throne. So they would go through, they would kill the king, they would kill his sons, they would kill their sons, they would kill aunts, they would kill uncles, they would kill nephews, they'd kill any male that could claim the throne in an attempt to secure power to themselves. Saul knows that. And Saul says, I don't want that to happen to my family. David, you're a righteous man, so if you swear that you won't do that, I know you won't. So David, Saul's got more trust in David than Saul has in himself. Because he knows David will keep his word. Verse 22, David did swear this to Saul. And then Saul went home. He stopped chasing David, but where does David go? He went up to the stronghold. Why didn't he go home? I think he knows Saul. I think he knows better than to say, well, oh, good, Saul's finally relented. He's come around. Everything's going to be good from now on. I think David recognizes this was a momentary turn. This was unrequited mercy. I showed David mercy unlike anybody's ever showed another human up to that point. And he's not going to respond to it. So David just goes back to the stronghold where he knows he'll be safe. But we see in these two pictures a man who is, number one, willing to obey God, even if it looks like it's going to lead to more hardship and more misery, even if it looks like, from a practical standpoint, it's going to be the wrong decision. He's willing to just leave it in God's control and say, you know what, this is what God told me to do, so I'm going to do it no matter what. On the other hand, we got Saul, who even when he is shown mercy in an unbelievable way, is unwilling to relent from his desire to destroy somebody. So the kingly lesson for us today: when God gives you a command, do it. Don't question him. Don't sit there and try and reason out all the repercussions of what might happen if you do or don't do it. Just take David's path and do it. Let's pray.